Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's lovely to have you all back again. And what a big week we've had. Some big announcements, big Four Corners episode we saw recently on housing affordability, so we've got lots to talk about. But before we get stuck into that, let's have a quick chat to my two lovely co-hosts, Kate Bakos and Dave Johnston. Kate, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Pete. We've had a lovely, warm, sunny weekend, and we had Melbourne Cup to celebrate, and it does feel festive over here because we're really enjoying our freedoms.
Fantastic. It certainly was a warm weekend in the south of Australia, or the southeast of Australia. Bit of tropical weather. We had some hailstorms as well.
Yeah.
Dave, how about you? How are you going?
Feeling really good, Pete. Can totally concur. We took the four-day weekend with Cup Day being a public holiday in Melbourne, and like it seems half of Melbourne did, and it felt like a mini version of the summer holidays, to be honest, which was, yeah, great after the extended lockdown. So just, yeah, catch up with friends, and Halloween was in there, which is great fun. Yeah, so it's been a really nice break.
Excellent. We've certainly had a big week this week with stuff in the media about housing. Started off late last week with Christopher Joy coming out with a headline saying that property prices were going to drop 15 to 25% when interest rates rose. So I've done a little bit of research on that. So I'm very keen to give our listeners an insight into interest rates and its effect on house prices in the past, because it gives us an indication of what's going to happen in the future. We had the Big Four Corners episode. You know, a couple of the key phrases there were intergenerational theft. That was a big one. But yeah, they had some very good, well-known property professionals talking about that. The RBA's come out with some big stuff. And I know you're going to talk about the big picture stuff today, Dave. So without further ado, Dave, why don't you kick us off with some of your market update for this month?
Righto. So, do you know, Peter, I'd be interested to hear that high-level information you've sort of dug up, maybe to kick us off, if you're happy with that, on what's happened historically.
I like how we planned for this. Our planning session was a whole bunch of text messages. Dave and I probably had the wine flowing on Saturday night, and Pete woke up to the group chat and said,
I did.
Yeah. He did start it on Friday, though.
I thought it was cool. We saw the announcement and we strategized this session all over the weekend in the group chat.
So Christopher Joy used to work for RP Data CoreLogic. You know, I respect him very much so as a housing expert, but I think he's got this one wrong. He's certainly very outspoken. He doesn't mind saying what he thinks, and I certainly do admire that. But with many things, when you're trying to forecast, you look back in the past, there's no guarantee that history is going to repeat itself. But if you look at what's happened in the past, it gives you a good indication what might happen in the future. So what I did, and we'll put these up on our notes, what I did is go back 30 years and have a look at what's happened to interest rate rises and property prices. So sometimes the interest rate increase cycle went only for 6 months. Other times it went for a year. Other times property prices increased over a period of almost 2 years. So what I looked at is during that period of interest rate rise, what happened to property prices? So we look at June 94 to December 94. I know that's a long way away and things have changed, but you know, stay with me because I do have more recent dates. So June 94, interest rates were the cash rate was 4.75. So imagine what interest rates were. The cash rate was 4.75. 6 months later, it was 7.5. So it increased by 2.75%. and house prices still increased. Even though property, even though the cash rate went up 2.75%, house prices increased by 1.1%. Then we move forward to September 99 to September 2000. So in that 1 year, interest rates rose a total of 1.5%. But property prices still rose by 7.5%.
Do you guys remember that? I was reasonably young and I remember getting the letter each month. It felt like it was every second month from the lender saying, we're just advising you that your interest rate has moved again in response to the cash rate. And it was really hard. It was distressing because I was super young and, you know, first job out of uni, and I'm getting these letters on a regular basis, and they reset how much your minimum monthly repayment is. And it was significant. Do you remember those letters rolling in, Dave?
I do. There weren't any emails because email wasn't that popular back then, but there was certainly a lot of letters coming in.
Yeah.
First year uni, I hadn't bought a property in 1994, but I do remember it in 99 to 2000. And yeah, look, at that point, by then I'd started earning a reasonable income, thankfully. So I didn't find it stressful. It was just what was happening, and it was interesting times.
It felt like every month. I'm looking at the chart now.
Yeah, it was.
November, February, April, May, August, September. That would certainly feel, you'd be asking yourself, when are the letters going to stop?
Yeah. What's that, 6 or 7 times in the space of a year?
That's right. And it happened again in 9-10, and I remember the same feeling. And by that stage I had multiple loans, and, yeah, you'd be looking at the increase each month and your minimum contribution and provisioning for the same thing to happen next month.
Yeah, and look, people probably should be mentally preparing for something like that to occur in the coming years, and I think it's important to do, and it's why lenders put the buffers on the assessment rates and why APRA have just increased that buffer as well.
What was interesting, and I'm looking at Pete's chart now, I remember one of those months in 2000 when we hit 50 basis points increase in 1 month. That was a little bit of a shock. But all of the others are 25 basis points right across the board. And it's interesting, when rates go up, they tend to do these small incremental increases. But when rates go down, you see some significant increases. And I don't know if you remember, but when we came out of the GFC, we were hit with a 1% decrease. That was so significant.
Yeah, a major shock. They certainly go harder, don't they?
Yes.
And with bigger discounts. But, yeah, like that, when that 50 basis point increase occurred, there was a lot of, wow, you know what, we didn't expect that. But it does make it potentially a bit easier to manage when it's 25 basis increases at a time. But obviously it's all relative to your own situation and how often they do it.
Well, I'm looking at all of these cash rates during these times that we're referring to. They were all well over 5% cash rate. December 94, 7.5%. September 2000, 6.25%. I recall as a young investor, I would fix when the fixed rate went under 6.5% because it was so cheap.
And now there are fixed rates at 2.5%.
That's right.
How times change. Now, for all of our listeners, if you're at the gym or you're running or you're walking or you're doing something else, just take 10 seconds and listen to this carefully. And if you're not sitting down, you need to sit down. So March 2002, December 2003, that's 1.75 years, interest rates went up 1%. Did property prices go backwards? No. In that particular time period, they increased by 36%. So here we have Christopher Joy saying, oh, when the cash rates increased by 1%, property prices will drop. Back in 2002, 2003, they actually increased by 36%. So we're going crazy at the moment saying, oh, you know, property prices all over the country have gone up, you know, 20% or more. But here we have a time period where they went up by much more than that. So to me, it says not that when interest rates go up, property prices go up. To me, it says that there are other factors other than interest rates that affect house prices. And Dave and I and Kate were talking just before we started recording, and one of our upcoming shows is going to be on the different factors that affect house prices to see if we can work out maybe which ones are the major ones. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these now, because Kate and Dave also have some fantastic market updates. But just to let you know, in the last 30 years, interest rates went up six times. There were six interest rate increase cycles. In every single time, not once did property prices go backwards. And in fact, you'll see some other notes up there. Out of those six times, property prices rose more during those increases than in the corresponding period before they were increased. So, for example, in March 2002 to December 2003, when property prices rose by almost 36%, in the previous time period, which was 1.75 years, they only went up by 23%. So interest rates going up to stop property prices going up is not as effective as people think. It's a very blunt instrument that impacts on the whole economy, not just property prices. And Kate, I remember you were saying earlier on, I think before we started recording, you know, they don't always increase interest rates just because house prices are going crazy. Yes. There are other reasons why they do that.
And it's interesting because that's our focus. The three of us, we're property professionals and it's our world. But there are lots of other moving parts in the total economy, even just our national economy, that deserve various treatments when it comes to interest rate and policy setting. And house prices is one small facet. We've got all kinds of things that we're grappling with at the moment, from wages growth to GDP to managing inflation to offshore pressures to instability in the world. There's so many moving parts. And I don't think interest rate rises are targeted at slowing down the Australian housing market. There are other measures and we all know that. We've even seen some of those macroprudential levers being pulled in an effort to ease the rate of growth. And I think that's a really sensible way of approaching this.
Well, they certainly did back in 2017 when they imposed a higher deposit requirement for investors and a higher interest rate for investors and a higher interest rate if it was interest only as compared to principal and interest. Because there are certainly less investors buying rental property. And even though that may have partly had the effect of slowing down property price rises, unfortunately what it's done is increase rents and decrease vacancy rates, which means rents at a very high level. And, you know, with all our new migrants coming in the new year and beyond, you know, people are going to wonder where all these people are going to live, because most of them have to rent. They can't buy, not allowed to buy. Where are they going to live? You know, that's another story. Dave here has got some fantastic big picture stuff, as he usually comes up with. Dave, you want to start us off with the CoreLogic October data?
Yeah, well, look, the CoreLogic October data, basically nationally we're looking at a growth rate in line with the last 2 months, really. So it's sort of hitting a level at the moment nationally of around 1.5%. Monthly growth. So October to as at October 31 was 1.49%. September was 1.51. August was 1.5. So it's really sort of hitting a level. So that's still 18% when you annualize it. And we're up to 21.58% annual growth across the broader Australian property market over the last 12 months. So if we break that down into a bit more detail, Brisbane is going really strongly. So it's picked up to 2.54% and had the highest month-on-month growth. So there's a fair bit of money moving up north and into the Brisbane market. Hobart is still at 2% off, you know, extreme highs, but down from 2.3% in the last 2 months. So maybe we're finally seeing some easing of the market in Hobart. But
1% in a fortnight is massive growth by anyone's measure. 2% monthly increase, if that happens every month,
that's huge.
That's Hobart tracking at 24%. That is insanity. That I think anything that's a solid percentage in that monthly column is still outperformance growth, because even if every city just did 1%, that's still 12% per annum. It's very, very strong.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, it feels like it's on its way to passing Melbourne's median, you know, like it's just not going to slow down.
The Four Corners program came up with a very interesting stat, and that is Hobart property prices are quite high, right, relative to the rest of the country, but their average income is 15% below the national income. So it's showing that it's not just the locals that are buying property, it's the richer people on the mainland that are buying property there. You know, that's why places like Noosa and Byron Bay are so expensive. It's not like people in Noosa, people that live permanently in Noosa earn a fortune. The people that holiday in Noosa maybe earn a fortune, but not the people that live there. Again, why Hong Kong is so expensive, Dubai is so expensive, because they have rules where basically anyone in the world can buy. So, you know, rich people buy there. That's the people with the money that drive property prices, hence why property is so expensive in those places.
And that is why when we look at combined capitals and combined regionals on this chart that's hot off the press, the regionals are outperforming nationally, quarterly, and monthly. They're still going. And that's because we still have people from the cities escaping to the regions. And as much as we'd like to think that that is dying down and we're starting to love our cities again, still in the data.
Getting a breakdown of where people live who are buying property in a city or a regional city would be really interesting data, wouldn't it? Because I think it'd tell a story when you've got a lot of money coming from elsewhere into that market. Just directly to your point there, Pete, you'll definitely see a correlation with property price growth. And, you know, I think that's a big factor of the, you know, superstar cities that outperform across the world, some of which you just mentioned. And it's interstate and overseas money that really makes that difference in those markets. And it's exactly what's been happening in the regional centres, isn't it, Kate?
Whenever I am bidding at auction for anything, I always like to quiz the agent in the final couple of days before the auction, after they've had their vendor chat and they've done their call arounds and they know who's home in the zoo. And I always say to them, how many bidders are you expecting? And they're pretty good. The general information that I get is usually just bang on, and the agents completely get their numbers right when they've done that full ring around. And if they know you and they're happy to chat to you, they'll give you some insight. And I get right down to the detail in Geelong, and I'll say, any advocates, how many building inspections have you had? Can you tell me about your buyers? And in most cases, it's at least 3/4 of the buyer pool are Melburnian.
Yeah, tells a story.
It does.
It certainly does.
We've got this guy from Melbourne, we've got this couple from Melbourne, and this lady who's moving from Melbourne, and a couple of local buyers. And it's awful to see it when they feel despondent about their local buyers' opportunities or chances of success, because we do take our Melbourne money there, and it's not just that capital city incomes are necessarily higher. If someone's doing that tree change, they'll be throwing a strategy at it and they'll be determined to get that property, because it's taxing on them doing all that driving and checking out properties week after week. They just want to make it happen. But also, you do tend to find that if Melburnians aren't doing their homework, they'll look at a beautiful property in Geelong and they might assume that it's similar to something that they saw in Melbourne, and they won't be factoring in the differing land values as well, so they might pay too much.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
So, Dave, one of the other interesting charts you have here is looking at graphically the growth in the month of March this year compared to the month of September and October. And basically for almost every capital city, March was a much better month than any of those other months, except maybe for Brisbane, where it's showing October was better than March. In Adelaide, October was better than March, so maybe they still got some more steam in their property market. But for the other six capital cities, the first half of the year was much better than the second half of the year.
Yeah, 100%, which tells sort of the broad story across the country, but it also does tell some micro stories, doesn't it? Money's moving to Brisbane and money's moving to Adelaide. And I think, you know, and Adelaide sort of underperformed, and I think, you know, interstate investors are seeing an opportunity in Adelaide. And I think we could continue to see that trend in Adelaide, Pete, with its median being a bit lower relative to similar sized capital cities. And I know you've certainly been talking about feeling it on the ground over there with the competition. And yeah, so I think people are seeing an opportunity in Adelaide that's starting to show a real trend.
We were in Brisbane on the weekend We went to see our eldest daughter, and as much as I'd like to say that Adelaide was going to be the stellar market, Southeast Queensland is going to, it may not outperform in property price because price is dependent on demand and supply. And I know lots of people are moving up to Southeast Queensland. If they build lots of houses to supply that market, property price is not going to move much, okay? But certainly, just like happened back in the 80s and the 90s, there is a big movement of Mexicans. Mexicans are people that live south of the border, moving up to Southeast Queensland. I spoke to many real estate agents, property managers, people that work in property. Kate, you've got one of your workers is moving up to the Gold Coast, but she's going to continue to work for you. So it's just phenomenal, the amount of movement from cities to regional areas and from parts of Australia up to Southeast Queensland. Just phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, we were had a couple of friends over for a drink yesterday afternoon, and one of the couples are considering moving from round here, Hawthorne East, up to Noosa. And, you know, that's something they're discussing right at the moment. So there's a big drive to move up there, isn't there?
Oh, there certainly is. We actually visited Noosa. Noosa's one of my favourite holiday spots, but property prices there have just gone crazy. It's interesting, you know, when times are good, generally, they are really, really good in holiday locations. But when times are bad, they're really, really bad in holiday locations. So people need to be very wary about that.
I think there's going to be a lot of people caught holding the baby.
I think so too. When all this calms down, yeah.
Historically, we have, haven't we? In holiday locations, big runs, and then lengthy flat periods.
Yeah.
I've said to a lot of people, try before you buy. Rent your house out and go and rent something. And if market volatility is a fear, that's a very genuine thing to be mindful of. This chart that we're looking at, and we'll have it in the show notes, you both commented that March looks strong. The month of March compared to September and October across the board is generally quite dominant. And there is a reason for that. And if you cast your minds back to March and think about how we all felt about the coronavirus in March nationally, what do you both recall?
Delta was either we hadn't even heard of it or it was, she'll be right. But she
wasn't
right.
We'd reopened and Australia had zero cases and everyone was celebrating that. And we had very quickly got our heads around the fact that we had our freedom back and Australia was ahead of everyone else in terms of managing this thing. And then things got pretty pear-shaped.
And then it hit the fan after that.
Yeah.
And also, home builder was coming to an end. That stimulus was coming to an end. Yeah. Sorry, Dave, I cut you short, mate.
Oh, well, I thought Kate might have also been going that we're probably coming to that place again at the moment, you know, where we feel like COVID's behind us. And, you know, obviously Victoria and New South Wales opened up, borders opening up to everywhere other than the Hermit Kingdom over
the Republic
in Western
Australia. WA.
But so it will be interesting to see where that. We know people, there's still $200 to $300 billion of savings estimated in people's bank accounts and offset accounts. So obviously there's a lot of people are going to be spending a lot of that on holidays. But, yeah, will we see more of a rush of money into the property market again maybe as we're feeling like COVID is behind us? And even with the opening up, the numbers are going down in Melbourne and Sydney, aren't they, with cases. So it's really showing the vaccinations
working. It's not just, I don't think it's just people saving money, but if look at investors, and this is, you know, this is just my example and one person doesn't, you know, we can't generalize here, but, you know, the amount of money in my rental accounts at the moment, I haven't seen that grow as much ever. One, interest rates are down, so my costs have dropped, and two, rents are increasing significantly. So when we talk about money in the bank, it's not just the savings, but for investors, it's almost impossible to negatively gear because interest rates are so low. So what's happening is instead of your bank balance dropping down and then you have to top it up because you're negatively geared, the bank balance is slowly going up. So it's certainly a very pleasant time to be a property investor to see the bank balance actually increase rather than continually decrease and then having to top it up.
And I don't know about you, Pete, but vacancies, we're not having to shoulder vacancies.
No, it's just amazing, yeah.
Just to delineate, that's the story of a multi-property owner who's owned property for quite a period of time, whereas someone getting in today, it's still subject to where you buy and what you buy. You still could be negatively geared from day one. But yeah, if you've owned property, multiple properties over a number of years, yeah, that differential between the rent and the low interest rates has gotten wider and wider, hasn't it, Pete?
It has, it has. And you've got a great chart here, Dave, on rents, houses versus units. And Darwin and Hobart and Perth top the chart for houses and units. Darwin almost 20% for houses and units 19%. That is just phenomenal. Well, it must be lots of people moving up there or nobody building up there. I don't know. Is it demand or supply? Is it both? I'm not sure what's happening there. Phenomenal.
Well, if we look at Melbourne units on this chart for the first time since all of this broke, Melbourne got as low as minus 13%, meaning that our rents for units, median rents, were down 13% off our last high, and we're finally back into positive territory now. Only 0.2, but it means that rents have recovered for Melbourne units, and I think that's incredible. When we focus on how many horrible units there are in Melbourne, undesirable rental properties, and limited numbers of people to soak them up from a rental point of view. And what we know from our past episodes where we talked about total stock on market is a lot of owner-occs are buying these properties.
Yeah, and, you know, talking to the, I guess, the rental story, if we're looking at yield, even though the rents are going up, property values are going up at a faster rate. So the actual rental yield is still very low. So the average yield, and that isn't on this chart. I got Anne-Marie to pull together to get me this chart just before we got on. So sorry, you two don't have it, but I'll get it added to the monthly pack. But houses are only 2.2% yield in Sydney on average and 2.4% in Melbourne. And so that's why if you're buying an investment property today, when you factor in your interest rate and your holding costs, you're still actually generally negatively geared. So it's this hard thing for people sometimes to wrap their heads around. Rents are going up, but the percentage of the rent relative to the value of the property is actually coming down. And so the actual average yield in Sydney and Melbourne is probably as low as it's ever been, at only 2.2% and 2.4%. And that's is happening because people can still afford that yield because interest rates are so low. But it's also why investors are being attracted to the other markets, like Brisbane's average house yield is 3.6, unit 3.9, Adelaide 3.8, units 4%, Hobart's 3.7 for a house, 3.8 for a unit. I mean, Darwin's 5.6% for a house and 6.1% for a unit. So
that's really strong. They would not have a chance of being negatively geared at all.
No, it'd be almost impossible. That's right. So, David, in your next group of charts and graphs, and I think it's the graphs that really make it striking. So we've got total listings, new listings and total listings. What's really made an impression on me is the total listings. So we've got data going back 6 years. And in 2021, we have the lowest amount of listings in the last 6 years, which again tells the story, which we've said on a number of times on the show. You know, price is a function of demand and supply. There may not be lots more of us looking to buy, but there is a lot less property to buy, which is one of the main reasons property prices are going up and property rents are going up too.
I love that chart. And if we look at the following page, which it puts it all together in a table, there's not many capital cities showing on here that are demonstrating a different story. They're all telling a common story here, and that is in the case of just 1 year, our total available listings have halved. So if we look at the old listings, that means they're greater than 180 days. That's the one that I'm really focusing on. The super old stuff that's been floating around that no one wanted, even in a hot market, people now want them. And you can see that the total number of old listings, so stuff that's been on the market for greater than 180 days, is pretty much halved.
If you want to get an idea, another reason why Hobart property prices are going crazy, not just because the richer people from the mainland are buying, but in Hobart today, there are 63% less listings today than there were 12 months ago. almost two-thirds less property. In Canberra, 62% less. Adelaide, 60% less. Brisbane, 63% less. You know, when you've got such low amount of stock, even if you keep demand at the same level, property price is only one way to go, and that's up.
You look, COVID hit, people stopped buying for 6 months. Then we felt like we had it under control. People got confident, big bank balances, and the floodgates opened, didn't they? People have just been buying up and buying up property. Thankfully, new listings have really grown in the last couple of months, particularly because Melbourne and Sydney have come out of lockdowns to start to sort of balance the ledger. So new listings are significantly up after those lockdowns. I think 20% or so in the last month. So, you know, that ledger might be starting to balance out a little bit again, but still it's got a long way to go for overall listings, hasn't it?
It certainly has, yeah. And I think one of the reasons why there is a limited supply is consumer sentiment, Dave, and that's your next table there, the Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Sentiment. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the overall consumer sentiment is staying pretty consistent, which is somewhat positive at about 104.6. But as the regular listeners will know, I like to look at the time to buy dwelling index. And so it's dropped down further again. So people are more pessimistic about it being a good time to buy a dwelling. It's come down to 83 after sitting at popping back up, and it did drop into the 80s, I think, a couple months ago, but last month was 96. So people are feeling pretty negative about, or more negative about it being a good time to buy a dwelling. But I don't think that necessarily means people stop buying. I think
I was just about to say, I don't feel there's a correlation.
No, yeah, I don't think so either.
It takes a while to play out. I think it, you know, yeah, it could be 6 months down the track. The last thing I'll just say on that is, actually, the House Price Expectations Index, I shouldn't be laughing so hard, but it's at a whopping 156. So, you know, people think house prices are very high. That's sort of off the charts.
Look, the sentiment is that, you know, prices are going crazy and a lot of people are asking if we're at the peak. And I meet people every single day who start the conversation by saying, it's probably a crazy time to buy, but. And they're going into the property market because the fear of price movement continuing is obviously greater than the fear of buying at the peak.
Dave, vacancy rates, if you're going to say it in one word, it'd be low, wouldn't it? Or two words is very low.
Yeah, low, very low, and staying pretty consistent. But when we start getting migrants, international migrants coming in, I think we're going to see some more pain point. I mean, investor numbers are going up, which, you know, depending on which story you want to tell is a positive or a negative in terms of more supply for people, which can keep rental prices lower, but maybe, you know, obviously it potentially says first time buyers can't afford to get into the market. So, depending on your perspective, you can see the same fact as being a negative or a positive on that point.
Certainly is. Both, yeah, two sides of the story there. Dave, this is your domain. Lending indicators. What can you tell us about loans?
Yeah, so look, the story continues to that point with investor numbers increasing. So they're up 1.4% in September, whereas owner-occupiers fell 2.7%. And first-time buyers fell, but it was a smaller fall of 1.9% of those overall owner-occupiers, where they had bigger drops month-on-month of between about 5 and 8% the prior 3 months. So first-time buyers might be starting to find their level. So overall, new loan commitments investors are up at about 31%. And I mentioned it each month when APRA stepped in 2015, and really clamped on investors, they're up at 46%.
Right. There's some very interesting lending data there. I think we're not going to see too many first-home buyers in for next year because the home buyer grant, what that did, one of the things is it just brought forward demand. If you were thinking of buying in 2021, late 2021, 2022, with the extra money around for home builder, you just decided to buy then. So the people that were going to buy have already bought. So we'll see their place taken by upgraders, downsizers, investors, and new migrants, I reckon.
It's a really good point, isn't it? And it doesn't get talked about when the media is looking for headlines.
No, no. They forget about what happened last year when first-time buyers were at record levels. We're only looking at what's happening now. Yeah. And Dave, the last point we're going to chat about for our market update is inflation.
Yeah, so inflation is becoming more of a story. Australia hit within its target, the RBA's target band of inflation for the first time in a long time at underlying inflation at 2.1%, and they aim for 2% to 3%. So we're recording 3rd of November, and the RBA met yesterday on Cup Day, and they have said they'll no longer target the three-year bond yield, which they're aiming to keep at 0.1%, which essentially keeps three-year fixed rates lower. So the bond markets have been pricing in increases in interest rates, and it had pushed up above 1%. And so what the RBA had been doing was buying that bond to keep the yield down at 0.1%, but they've said yesterday they're no longer going to do that. So that's earlier than expected. So that yield came back down a bit to about 0.9% yesterday. So, you know, we've seen, I've talked about it on the podcast, how interest rates in terms of when you're going to borrow money from a lender are starting to increase, not the RBA's rates. And, you know, that's been playing out with fixed rates particularly increasing for borrowers. And this is one of the functions that had been keeping fixed rates lower that the RBA is no longer going to be doing. They're still going to be buying $4 billion of government bonds per week, which still does keep these rates lower as well, but they're not specifically targeting the three-year bond yield. So that's a move. We've talked about how the RBA, you know, maybe a bit over the top, had sort of from early days of COVID guaranteed rates wouldn't increase till 2024. They now change their language that it's plausible that they may not increase until 2024, but they could increase in the back half of 2023 now. The money markets and economists are all thinking we could be getting increases next year, more to the second half of next year, but I think it's going to take a lot for the RBA to budge. Overall, in terms of inflation, which could be the main driver of rates to go up, if then wages go up as well, still most first world economies are thinking that it's not going to last longer term, and it's a function of various impacts of COVID, including the impact to supply chains, disruptions. Look, that's a high-level sort of synopsis.
And we love your high-level stuff, your big-picture stuff, Dave. And look, I think all of our episodes are great, but in particular this one, we've got data from a variety of places. We've got CoreLogic, SQM, ABS, the stuff that I done on interest rates. I got from government websites, the RBA and the ABS, and I've actually got links to it. So if people want to do their own research, just click on the links and you can do your own research and analysis. But hopefully this episode, we've brought our listeners up to date with what's happening and what might be happening in the future. And we also love your feedback. So please don't forget to send us a note. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what you want to hear more of, what you want to hear less of, because in the end, we are here for you. So before we disappear, we would love to hear Kate and Dave's gold nuggets. So don't go away just yet.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Kate, what's your gold nugget?
Well, I want to circle back to the initial conversation that we had when we started this episode. And we chatted about Christopher Joy's suggestion that a 1% rate increase could create some real issues in the property market. And I think you've done a really great overview, Pete, with your analysis. But when you talked about us coming down a full 1% back in the last couple of decades, it was coming off a higher base. So it was 1% when the cash rate was above 5%. And I think we do have to be cautious with sprinkling any fairy dust on a fear like this. I certainly don't want to fuel the fear, but if we did have interest rate movements of 1%, we've already got a super low cash rate. And if we look at the actual rate, even if someone is paying 3%, which in today's world is not necessarily a discounted interest rate, that would be a full one-third of the entire interest that they're calculating their repayments on. It would be very significant. So I think that I look at that headline and that claim that he's made and ask myself, well, how likely is it that we would have a solid interest rate movement or a collection of short interest rate increases over a tiny period to 1%? I don't think that that's likely in this climate.
I agree 100%, Kate. I actually think the interest rate rises this time around will have a greater effect. Number one, we're coming from a very low base, like you say, 0.1 to 1.0. But also, we have not had an interest rate rise or cash rate rise for 11 years. So some people that have owned property have not seen an interest rate rise. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. Dave, your gold nugget.
Okay, so my gold nugget for today is a bit of an insight, I suppose, into why I look at the macro picture, whether it's other nations' economies and geopolitical issues that might be going on between countries, and how that can flow down to impacting the Australian economy, because you know, we're only about the 12th or 13th largest economy in the world, and ultimately how it can impact the property market and property prices. So at the moment, something you know that's on the radar for most people is the potential of when are interest rates going to rise. So that's going to be driven to some degree by inflation. And so reading it, and inflation is something that hasn't happened for quite some time. So it's a really interesting time to watch what plays out with regards to what's causing inflation. Is it long-lasting inflation? Is it only temporary? You know, is it off the back of the limited supply of people being able to travel, the stimulus that has been provided by countries around the world? What sort of one-off factors due to the COVID pandemic are causing potentially this inflation, and is it short-term or long-lasting? What are other countries doing? So a number of countries have lifted interest rates: Norway, New Zealand, South Korea, Pakistan, Hungary, Paraguay, Brazil. What is the impact of semiconductors, for example, not being able to be made available around the world as freely, and how that impacts the price of cars and all sorts of other goods, which can then cause inflation, which can ultimately lead to interest rate rises. So, yeah, I guess my gold nugget is just, and that's just barely even touching on, but just sharing some insights into why I do find the macro picture so, on a global scale, so fascinating. And it's a particularly fascinating time because, you know, first global pandemic in 100 years, and also the fact that inflationary pressures are starting to build, and that isn't something we've seen for quite some time.
Thank you very much for that, Kate and Dave. Very interesting and insightful episode today, very educational, and look forward to having you all back next week. Bye for now.
See you then.
If you've enjoyed this latest market update, we suggest you take a listen to episodes number 4, How to Develop Your Own Property Plan, Start with the End in Mind. Number 8, Interpreting Data to Uncover an Outstanding Property and Location, How to Sort the Gold from the Lies, Damn Lies and Statistics. Episode 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. And episode 27, How many properties do you need to retire wealthy?
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.